Welcome to the 118th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. Hello, my name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome if this is your first time listening. I hope all of you mothers had a happy Mother's Day weekend. Mine was pretty relaxing. I had a surprise visit from my daughter, so that was a whole lot of fun. As many of you know, my mother has been under the weather, actually with some arrhythmia problems. She's getting better. We're still adjusting medications, and so we've been quite cautious, and so we ate in. I made stuffed manicotti, and I used tofu, spinach, stuffing for the manicotti, and I made homemade sauce with fresh tomatoes and mushrooms and some peppers. So we were careful to watch the salt intake for her and for us too. You know, we don't like to eat a whole lot of salt. We did have a little day trip and went to a little restaurant called Sweet Tomatoes where you can get salad bar type of things and controlled. But for the most part, we've been really focusing on watching salt intake. So, and that's worked out really good. I am getting back into triathlon training, so swim, bike, run season. So I've been back to the pools. I joined a new master's swim program and getting back into doing intervals with that and working my yardage back up. I think I did 2,500 yards last week. And the goal is to swim twice a week and gradually work my yardage up to Ironman distance yardage, along with some speed and technique and drills. You know, it's like anything else. You lose the feel for the water. So you have to get back in and not only get your swim fitness, but your feel for the water back in. Swimming reminds me a whole lot of golf. It's very technique oriented. I grew up as a golfer, and I could look at a swing and pick it apart and tell, you know, if somebody was going to hit a ball one way or the other. So now I'm the victim, and I'm trying to figure out my swim stroke to get myself efficient. So it takes a long time, especially when you're just trying to do it two days a week. But it's a lot of fun. I find it very relaxing. Sometimes it's hard to get started in swimming. You know, I don't have trouble running out the door to go for a run. But the swim, you know, I guess it's because it's not, you know, what I consider something I've done a lot. There's a little bit of dread as far as getting there, you know. But once I get in the water and start swimming, I find it very enjoyable. So, you know, like I said, it takes a while to get back into things. Biking, I'm doing my Zwift during the week on the trainer and then rides outside on the weekend. I'd like to exercise early in the morning, so. And I'm not going to go out and ride in the dark. It's scary enough riding on the roads in the daylight, but I'm certainly not going to take any risk in the dark. So I do the Zwift, and I did a time trial this week, so it lets you know your wattage. So I'm enjoying that. I get a really good workout doing that, so I think it's good. I'm also continuing to lift and adding that incorporation, a couple lifts a week if possible. And I talked a little bit about last week about the, you know, goal of mine is to lift a little bit heavier and push that a little bit more. So I'm doing that. And I actually ordered a hex bar. I listened to a podcast. A hex bar is made like a hexagon. It's for doing deadlifts. So the goal is to get a kind of a run specific force development with the hex bar. So we'll let you know how that goes. As you know, besides endurance training, my other hobby is backyard gardening, and it's getting hot here in Florida. We hit 90s yesterday, but still have tomatoes and sweet potatoes and picking the last part of the Brussels sprouts. There's still some fennel down there. Fruit trees are starting to come in. I have a few mango trees and avocados that are hanging on. I did something interesting, though. I saw it on Facebook, and I decided to try it, is planting tomatoes in pots. And what you do is if you have a tomato that's going rotten on your, you know, not fit to eat, it's soft, slice it into horizontal slices and take the little seeds, look like little pancakes, and put them on top of the soil on a pot, and then cover them with potting soil, and you will grow a tomato. And so I tried that in several pots, and I have little tomato plants coming up. So I'm going to nurture those in the pots until they get big enough to transplant into the ground. We'll see how that goes. And then this time of year, again, because it's so hot, we have herbs on the porch. We do have some cucumbers and beans, so we're going to have to figure out some way to shade those a little bit. But otherwise, things are going good. We continue to work on our raised beds and, making those, kind of doing some more of framework and, I guess, the aesthetics of gardening, put some rock around those this summer. And so making things look a little bit better around the raised beds. Who knows, someday we may be able to do a little garden tour around the house with my nutrition class. So that's kind of the ultimate goal. Yesterday in the nutrition class was a day we went shopping. So we go to a local grocery store down here in Florida. We have a chain called Publix. And we, as a group, walk around, spend most of the time in the produce section looking at vegetables people may or may not have eaten and discussing ways to cook them. We also look at a lot of packaging. They put the crackers and what they kind of call their healthy snacks in the produce aisle. And the reality of it, that it's not just Publix, but grocery stores in general, you pay more to put those packaging in, more of an eye-catching area. So the chips and things and crackers that go in the deli pay a higher shelving rent, so to speak, than just in the potato chip aisle. And one thing we noticed yesterday as a group, there's, in the deli aisle, they have, the pretzel thins and pita chips. And, of course, kale chips are starting to become popular. And now they had kale chips and they had a garden chip. And then they had these beet chips because beets, as we know, real beets and beet tops mixed with the amylase and the bacteria production in your tongue, and you actually produce nitric oxide, which helps you dilate your blood vessels, which is very healthy. So they made beet chips, right? Because if you're going to market something, now beets are popular, we're going to make it into a junk food. And so the beet chips, and of course they're red and the package is pretty and, they're natural and all those other falsifying marketing labels are on there. But the interesting thing is the beet chips actually had the most fat and salt of any of the chips and crackers in that aisle. So it just goes to show you, the one that they're packaging and marketing the most is certainly not necessarily the healthiest. And really the reality of it, none of them are healthy. So, again, eat your beets like beets. So, you can steam them, boil them, roast them. Eat them raw, but don't put a bunch of oil and salt and bake them. That's not the way to go. You lose everything you're trying to get to. The other thing that we point out every class is the hummus. Hummus is a great thing. It's made out of chickpeas, but when you buy store-bought hummus, it contains an awful lot of oil in it. And a lot of other things, but the oil makes it very, very high in calories. And of course that the processed oil is not good for you. So I always give my students a recipe to make their own hummus. But I just like to point out that, a lot of times people think that they're eating hummus and one, they're not losing weight because they're eating this, very calorie dense oil laden hummus. And the other thing that they're going to adversely affect their lipid profile with all the oil. And that's one of the big things we point out while we're shopping is, all the oil in different things. When we got over to the spaghetti sauce aisle, virtually every spaghetti sauce in a jar has oil in it. And again, we found that, one of the organic, most naturally healthy appearing spaghetti sauces in a jar had the most oil in it. So you're really better off making your own pasta sauce, and it's so easy. The tomatoes in the box that are just tomatoes, and you can add your own herbs, basil, oregano, and garlic, mushrooms, and it makes a great sauce. I like to add hot peppers to mine, and it makes a great sauce, and it's just as quick. and you can avoid all the oil, and you can really control the salt, because when you use just tomatoes to start with, you're cutting out a tremendous amount of salt from the tomato sauce, so it makes it so much more healthy. My heart failure patients that go out, you know, when they get the oil and the salt, they oftentimes get in trouble, and then you throw the bread that's been dipped in the butter and this, you know, and the salt and all that kind of stuff. You can really get into trouble with heart failure. So you have to really focus on that. You know, it's always said, don't go to the grocery store when you're hungry, because you'll buy things that you really wouldn't buy otherwise. And I do think that that is true. It's a very tempting place. You know, we did the produce aisle, and we did the aisles where the beans are. And of course, I pointed out the bad stuff on the sauce aisle, but there's, you know, some other things along there, the rice and everything. But, you know, we avoid the aisles that are bad. So it really is shopping the perimeter. We did the produce aisle and, you know, where you can get dry goods aisle, and then back over to the frozen foods aisle to point out some vegetables and different, you know, frozen products, you know, some of the Gardein things to be on occasion, and that, you know, to actually explain, you know, some of the good ones, the better ones, you know, less salt, more oil. But the reality of it is, it doesn't take much room for shopping plant-based, you know, a couple aisles and you have it. That's kind of why I like to go to small markets. If not a health food store, we have a market that's mainly vegetables, and we have a small Walmart market that's very small with a produce section. So I shop there because I can just go in and get my produce and go out, because I don't need all those other aisles. You know, the big box stores have aisle after aisle after aisle of bad things. And so if you go into those places, you know, you kind of get sucked down those aisles, and you end up coming out with a bunch of things that, you know, I think I'll try this or I'll try that. And those beet chips were something that I'm sure they sell a ton of those, because it catches people's eye, because, you know, you go in and you think, oh, beets are good and I'm hungry and I'm in the deli and it must not be that bad and we'll give those a try. It's better than potato chips. I mean, you go down that aisle very quickly. So, you know, think about trying to shop in smaller stores or just focus on staying in the produce section. So I'm going to turn my attention now to a study I actually posted on Facebook that kind of lit things up a little bit. With some interesting comments. Some people ask me how I get information for the podcast each week, and it's usually something that happens to me either in the office or in nutrition class or just in life in general. And this red meat study was one that I found very interesting. So there was a study published in the British Medical Journal, which is a peer-reviewed journal, looking at heme iron, or iron that comes from blood, typically in beef or red meat. And when they talk about red meat, it's just not cow. It's lamb and pork as well as beef. And they looked at 500,000 people for 15.6 years. The age of these people ranged from 50 years of age to 71 years of age. And they did a detailed dietary questionnaire, and they determined the amount of iron they took in the form of heme iron based on their red meat consumption, which again was beef, pork, and lamb. And they looked at all-cause mortality, which means death from any reasons, as well as cancer, cardiovascular disease, stroke, respiratory diseases such as chronic obstructive lung disease, diabetes, kidney disease, liver disease, Alzheimer's. And this was a United States study, and there were actually six states. Florida was one of the states. The other thing that they concentrated on was the heme iron, and then also nitrates or nitrites, which would be from processed meats. Over that 15.6-year period, out of the 500,000, there were 84,848 deaths in males and 43,646 deaths in females. And what they found was that there was an increase in all-cause mortality when people consumed red meat. And most of that, or a lot, the majority, or the one of the highest of all the different things that I mentioned above, was that death due to chronic liver disease had the highest hazard ratio. The next one was diabetes, and the next one was respiratory diseases. This was thought secondary to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease from increased fat intake, also from these nitroso compounds that are often added to both processed and unprocessed meat. So that red color you see in the grocery store in your beef and your different, that actually is nitrates added to preserve that red color. And they also attributed insulin resistance and then direct hepatotoxins. Besides the nitrate compounds, there are other compounds added for preservatives. Now, it wasn't an easy study to tease out. They looked at other risk factors such as smoking and whether you ate vegetables. And actually, because people that eat vegetables have a lower risk in general, when they ate meat, it made it worse. The conclusion was that eating red meat was worse than eating white meat. What they also concluded from what they looked at, though, was that if you add white meat onto your red meat, it doesn't make things better. So just adding, you know, more meat in general to your diet doesn't help. But perhaps substituting white meat for red meat makes things better. And then that's where the controversy erupted, because as a plant-based doctor, they said, how could you recommend white meat? I'm not recommending white meat. The people that ate white meat still died, or there were still mortalities in people that ate white meat. What we're looking at is the potential causes of the toxicities of red meat and this heme iron. And, you know, it goes on to all sources of heme iron when we take in iron that can be, you know, trouble. Heme iron and the nitrates and nitrites are prooxidants, meaning they generate free radicals. They cause the oxidation of lipids. These nitroso compounds cause insulin resistance, which leads to coronary artery disease. Insulin-like growth hormone increases, which can increase the risk of cancer. So all those contribute to the badness of red meat. There's another compound called L-carnitine, which is also sold as, you know, a way to build muscle. But, there is actually a paper in Nature magazine. When you look at carnitine, it's delivered to the bacteria in your gut. And plus, L-carnitine interacts with this bad bacteria, you generate TMAO, which is trimethyl amyl nitrate, which is a cause of atherosclerotic disease. So, this L-carnitine is also present in chicken and fish, so it's one reason why animal protein is not something that you want to ingest. Interestingly, as well, this TMAO production is certainly worse in meat eaters. If you take people that have been vegan or vegetarian for a long time and give them meat, they don't possess the bacteria in their gut to actually increase this TMAO production. So it is, you know, by eating animal protein, you select for a gut bacteria that, again, are more dangerous as opposed to the gut bacteria that produce these short-chain fatty acids that have these great feedback as far as decreasing hunger, decreasing glucose production, decreasing cholesterol production, and, improving brain function. The other thing to take into consideration is cholesterol. So cholesterol is present in animals such as bird animals and fish animals, as well as beef, pork, pig animals, lamb animals, you know, so you get the point. So that there's cholesterol production, there's cholesterol in animals, and actually it's very similar across the board. So a serving of chicken, 25 grams of cholesterol per ounce, which is the same as beef. That is without the with the skin, it's about 20, without the skin, I'm sorry, it's about 20% less. So, I mean, it's not, we're not getting rid of tremendous amount of, when you eat skinless chicken breast, you're not getting rid of a tremendous amount of cholesterol. Fish is any place from 15 to 30% saturated fat. Saturated fat can be turned into cholesterol. So again, if you're looking to decrease your need for statins, so you're looking to decrease your cholesterol, a quick way to get rid of it is to eliminate animal products that contain cholesterol and saturated fat. To drive the fact home, a 4-ounce serving of beef has 103 milligrams of cholesterol, 25% saturated fat. Pork tenderloin, 106 milligrams of cholesterol, 26% fat. skinless chicken breast, 97 grams of milligrams of cholesterol, which is 23% saturated fat. Turkey, skinless breast, 78. Halibut, 47 milligrams of cholesterol. Salmon, 96 milligrams of cholesterol. And then if we look at beef tallow, which is used to make a variety of different gravies and sauces, it's 50% fat. Chicken fat is 30% saturated fat. Pork lard is 39% saturated fat. Turkey fat, 30% fat. So, you know, on and on and on. If you want to make cholesterol and you want to increase your fat content, then these animal products are where you're going to find them. It's not just the heme iron that causes the problem. It's the fat and the cholesterol. The other thing that we see is because of the crowding and the way chickens are raised, that 5 million people are poisoned each year by infections, you know, whether it's salmonella or E. coli. And a lot of the chickens, you know, you say it's always told to cook it very, very well to try to decrease these bacteria. Not all of the bacteria removed, even when high temperature cookings. But on the contrary, you generate these heterocyclic amines when you cook something to the point where you eliminate the bacteria, so you increase the cancer risk. Heterocyclic amines are on the government list for carcinogens. So if you grill chicken, you actually increase the heterocyclic amines by a factor of 10 greater than actually grilling beef. So you can see that, you know, it's hard to play this game. What do I eat, chicken or beef? The idea is eat plants and you'll be safe from all this. Pan scrapings, you know, I can remember back in the day when my mother would use the pan scrapings to make gravy. And of course, I hear it all the time. And those scrapings contain 500 parts per billion of this carcinogen called PHIP, which is 100 times more than in the beef itself. So when somebody, you know, they say, oh, we just use the beef scrapings to make gravy, or we use those scrapings to put it into soup or a stew, you're really increasing the carcinogens. And, you know, if you just do one serving a day, there was a huge amount of increase in abdominal fat in women when you looked at these servings of meat versus, you know, that's not. And, you know, that often comes up in the office, you know, women when they go through or approach menopause or that era of, say, 45 to 55, they gain a lot of abdominal fat. There's things all over the internet of how, you know, quick ways, don't eat bananas or don't eat this or that. But the reality of it is when we're consuming such a high-fat diet is really what it's accumulation over time. It just doesn't, you know, happen overnight. But again, multifactorial, that, you know, the amount of this stuff that people are consuming increases. About 7 to 8% of our calories to be in the form of protein, which is easily done on a whole food plant-based diet. When you start increasing your protein intake, of course, along comes with that, especially if animal protein's involved, is fat, saturated fat, and cholesterol. But we do know that that increases the risk of osteoporosis and kidney disease and insulin growth factor, which is also, a risk factor for cancer. If you looked at the Nurses' Health Study, which is a widely quoted health study, you know, looking at the nurses, and those that had the high protein diet or greater than 95 grams of protein a day, there was an increased risk of fractures. And you say, geez, 95 grams of protein, that's a lot. But if you look at a hamburger, it can contain 48 grams of protein. So it doesn't take a lot of animal protein to really get into those high numbers of protein that can be dangerous. People ask, well, what about athletes? You know, because athletes are turning over muscle, they're breaking down muscle, they're burning more calories. Do they need more protein? Yes, they do use more protein and break down more protein. But the reality of it is when you do exercise, your appetite increases. And if you're maintaining your weight or eating so that you're actually building muscle, you're increasing your protein through whole foods. So you don't have to worry about supplementing protein or focusing on protein, just eating adequate calories. When I turned to the comments I got on that article when I posted it, one person actually commented from a town where I grew up in that was, the people there are traditionally very unhealthy. Life expectancy is not great. And this person actually had had stents placed, but he didn't say it at the time. But he said, like, I'd rather take my chance of a heart attack or the chances of the red meat and enjoy my Delmonico steak. And I guess since he's had a stent placed, he knows what that procedure is all about. And he may feel good now because that particular problem that he had at that time has been corrected. And he's probably ignoring other problems that he has, because we know that if you have coronary artery disease, you certainly have a vascular disease in other locations. He didn't discuss that on Facebook. But the reality of it is, it's, you know, you put out one fire and you might feel good for a while, but how good do you really feel? Because if somebody has had a stent placed and they have vascular disease and they're on, I would presume, medications, they don't feel like their 20-year-old self. And so you start to settle, I guess, for how you feel. You know, the old adage, I'm not as young as I, you know, used to be, and it's just a matter of getting old, and I have to accept that. I think that's something that, you know, I don't think that's an excuse that you should just have to live with. This person was lucky, I would guess, if he just had stents placed. Anybody that's went through a bypass surgery, that is a very invasive surgery with a 4 or 5 day hospital course with your chest cracked open, and there's wires for the rest of your life in your chest, and the blood has been rerouted. To me, that is a very large risk versus the taste of a Delmonico steak. The other comment was that, you know, back to the Neanderthals, and Neanderthals lived on meat, and, you know, they did well. Well, you know, that one's easy, because the reality of it is, you know, back in the day, people didn't live to be very long. They just needed to live long enough to reproduce, and you can eat just about anything as long as you don't get some sort of infection or eaten by something else. As long as you can maintain calories to reproduce, the species goes on. So I don't think that's a fair assessment or a justification for why you should eat red meat in the face of this and of course multiple other studies. And that person's actually from the same town and has a tremendous incidence of heart disease in his family. And cancer. So, you know, we just don't want to see things for what they really are, you know, because I guess the way we grew up, we don't want to be insulted by how we grew up. I love my childhood. I love growing up in that little town, but the people of that town are very unhealthy. And, you know, you have to look outside and to change. And there are a few people in that town that actually listen to this podcast. And, you know, I mean, there's no kinder people than in that little town. You know, Simon and Garfunkel, the My Little Town. It was a great place to grow up and a great town. And if I could do one thing, it would be to help those nice people realize that the way they used to eat is not the way they should eat if they want to feel better and achieve their, you know, optimal health and wellness. The thing I want to touch on today is non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. It's not necessarily nutrition related, but it is endurance athlete related. And it's health related. We know that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs in the form of naproxen, Aleve, ibuprofen, Motrin, Celebrex, that class of medication in general increase the risk of a myocardial infarction. There was another study, British Medical Journal, 446,763 people were looked. If you were on non-steroidals, if they were on non-steroidals more than a week, greater than a month, increased risk of MI. Even if you were just on them, if they were just on them 1 to 7 days, risk is increased. And actually, the first month carries the greatest risk. There's also a risk of congestive heart failure or cardiomyopathies with these medications. There's a risk of renal failure, kidney disease because of necrosis of the tubules in the kidneys. There's a, you know, an obvious risk of gastrointestinal bleeding. And when we've looked at endurance athletes, there's a risk of hyponatremia, basically because of the effect on the kidneys. So when people take Motrin because they're having aches and pains, and then they go do an Ironman or a marathon to try to get themselves through it, they really increase the risk of kidney failure. And it's certainly not worth it in the at all. Also a risk of significant GI bleeding. And then, you know, myocardial infarctions and coronary artery disease. So if you take this and you put it into, you know, the full picture of, you know, endurance athletics these days, you know, more and more people are doing marathons and Ironman races, whether they're, you know, the bucket list races or people are taking them up to lose weight. A lot of times people aren't healthy when they start. They could be overweight. They get joint aches and pains. You know, when you train for one of these, you know, typically it's 12 weeks to 4 or 5 months to get ready for one, the minimum. And, you know, ideally people will train for, you know, short distances and work their way up over years. But there are people that, you know, and I was actually one of them, that went from, you know, never having run to going to run a marathon in less than a year. You're taking a big risk. You know, I considered myself pretty healthy when I started it. I was on the younger side, but still it was, you know, not without significant risk. If you add underlying coronary artery disease or diabetes or high blood pressure, and then you throw the mix of, you know, some of these medications on top to help you get through, you can see how you can get yourself into big trouble. And then the first thing people blame is, you know, the marathon itself, the distance itself, or the, you know, the race itself. And it really, really isn't. It's, you know, it's people's preparation. So, I mean, if I had any advice to give to people, it's, you know, exercise is a wonderful thing. It's going to help your diabetes. It's going to help your blood pressure. It's going to help your body, your bone mass, and everything. But you need to work up to it. And, you know, that bucket list needs to, that bucket list event needs to be postponed until your body's ready. When you start running, you beat the small tendons, you know, up a whole lot, and people get aches and pains. Again, that's when they start reaching for the Motrin, which is very dangerous. When you're carrying a lot of weight and you're starting to run, it's, you know, it's difficult. I agree with, you know, no pain, no gain a little bit, but, you know, take it into perspective as far as the durations. So, you know, this whole body approach with nutrition, plant-based nutrition, is going to help you get that weight off quickest and healthiest and to allow your body to heal. And there's also a lot of, you know, natural, you know, decrease the natural ways to decrease your inflammation by adding turmeric to your food. Ginger, pineapple, those are good ways to decrease the inflammation. But just to, you know, also be mindful about what you're doing. You don't want to have to take medications to try to beat yourself into being ready for these races. The first Ironman I did was Ironman Florida, and to get into the race, because there's so many people that wanted into the race, you had a better chance if you volunteered. And you were on-site volunteer, and so I volunteered for the medical tent. And, you know, I saw person after person who came in, you know, and most of the people in the medical tent had done stupid things. You know, they had a bad cold, they took cold medicine, they started out dehydrated, you know, they were having some sort of stomach bug, and they tried to push through it and got themselves dehydrated. And that's usually, you know, where it is, because again, you've invested so much time and money to train for these events. You don't want to pull out. So you force your way through, and you know, we all have the, you know, I'm going to tough it out, scenario. So it's very, very difficult, but, you know, go back to the, you know, the Motrins, you know, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and try to avoid them if you possibly can. then if you're on them, try to figure out a way to get off them and, you know, address your pains through other means, whether it's physical therapy, weight loss, some of these more natural anti-inflammatories. The other risk that it has is an increased risk of atrial fibrillation. So, you know, if you take exercise and you wind somebody's heart rate up that already has hypertension, you give them one of these, you're really setting them up for a potential problem. So, you know, I would tell you, please don't take the non-steroidals, especially on race day. I'll leave you with one more bit of information. There was just a study published this week in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, the global, regional, and national burden of cardiovascular diseases for 10 causes, 1990 to 2015. And if you don't believe me as far as, or you don't, or you aren't aware of just how big a problem this is, there were 422 million cases of cardiovascular disease, 19.9 million deaths due to cardiovascular disease. That's crazy as far as the number goes. You know, and it's can be just corrected so easily if we just change our nutrition. So I hope you take heed and start working your way to a whole food plant-based diet. It opens up a whole new world. We went shopping last night with the class, you know, and there's so many different things you can eat. It opens up different ethnic food varieties to try, different combinations of spices, different herbs, you know, wonderfully colorful vegetable dishes. So there's so much you can do, so many different fruits to try, especially now in the summertime when all the fruits are coming out. So I encourage you to expand your palate and try some of these great foods and get rid of the stuff that's just bogging you down and weighing you down and closing your arteries up. There was a study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that starts a debate on whether people under 40 should have their cholesterol tested because they may not be of a risk. And, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, does insurance companies want to fund putting all these people on statins? I think people should have their cholesterol checked, certainly at an early age to see where they are. Certainly if they may have some other risk factors, positive family history or they're overweight. But I think people need to know where they stand. So as a, you know, first adult physical, I think people should have a blood test. And if their weight's changing or their social environment's changed, they need to have a blood test because if nothing else, it's going to help you direct, knocks on the door, I need to change things, I'm getting out of hand. So it's just like getting on the scale in the morning and seeing what your weight is. I think it helps people stay in reality that, you know, there is a huge burden of disease out there, cardiovascular disease. You know, we need to nip this in the bud and we need to be motivated to change. And so if your values are starting to creep up and your nutrition is starting to decline, then it needs to be addressed. Certainly, if you're just going to have your cholesterol checked every year and you're not going to change anything, then you can say, well, then, you know, why? But I would hope that you have a physician that every year that when you get this blood test done and every year when you don't want to hear it, they still let you have it as far as and say, hey, you need to eat a whole food plant-based diet to get this under control and to decrease your risk of a major event because these plaques started laying down when people are in their teens, 20s. It just doesn't happen once you're 50 or 60 years old. So the reality of it is I think that we need to check these labs but also address the labs. And I always encourage my patients, and I'll encourage any of you, if you go to a doctor and they're going to run a test, then I would ask them, what are they going to do with the information of that test? And you also need to ask yourself, what am I going to do with the information that my physician gives me with regards to the results of that test? Because if I'm not going to do anything, then that's one thing. Or am I prepared to do something really invasive if that test shows something else? So food for thought on leaving you as far as know what you're going to do with the results of something that you know, if you're going to get tested. But I do believe that the better part of valor is to check your labs and see where you are and, you know, get busy trying to fix them and, you know, hone your diet in. If you're plant-based, but, you know, you may be a little bit more on the junk food or processed side of it, then you can change and make adjustments and then retest. So thank you again for listening today. Happy belated Mother's Day. I hope you get out and train. Don't take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories when you're out there doing your long-distance events, and try to get off of them if you're, you know, regardless. And if you have any questions, you can email me at jamiedelaney@gmail.com or look at the website, drdelaney.com. It's drdelaney.com. There's also a Jamie at, jami@drdelaney.com that you can email me. We'll do telemedicine conferences if you want to. And I'd like to help out any way I can. So enjoy your week, get out and move around, and eat your veggies.